Now, schools are finally back in session across the region today. Students in many districts got an extra week of vacation because snow and ice made driving treacherous. Those of us who had to continue going to work can relate. I had to keep the truck in four-wheel drive mode for the entire work week. We learn a few things about our vehicles in tough conditions and about our ability to deal with our vehicle's eccentricities. Let's talk cars and car care with Zach Edwards at Ashland Automotive, Inc. He'll be joining us monthly now for a segment we call the squeaky wheel, as in the squeaky wheel gets the grease, in this case, the airtime. Got a car issue or story to tell? Let's hear from you. 800-838-3760, jx@jeffnet.org. Hi, Zach. Good to see you again.
Hey, Jeff.
So I was just asking about how busy you get, and I guess I ask the same question a lot around wintertime, but it's really body shops, and you don't do body work, that probably get the majority of work when we get winter fender benders and stuff like that.
Yeah, we're doing a little bit of work right now with some bent wheels and bent suspension components from sliding into curbs, but we don't exchange body panels or straighten any body panels, and I do think that body shops take a lot of phone calls on the day the storm hits, and then the weeks after, they probably are pretty full with doing repairs.
So the stuff that you do though, having to straighten out wheel joints, things like that, do you get a fair number of people who have slid into curbs and other obstacles and banged up their stuff pretty well?
Yeah, we do. And we actually just bought an alignment rack that we're going to be installing in March, so that we can then, after the repairs are done, we can actually do the alignment, which typically we've had to have done at Les Schwab. But now we will be able to do our own, and it's a pretty big investment. But it makes a big difference in how long of tire life you get when your car is properly aligned. So any little bend in the suspension component is going to throw off the alignment angles, and then that's going to cause irregular tire wear. And, you know, tires are not getting cheaper nowadays, so it's really important to get the alignment checked periodically, preventatively, and especially after you've slid out and tapped a curb. Even a big pothole can really throw those angles off. So we're seeing a lot of that.
All right. I can relate, because there have been many a time I've taken the tires in and said, what do you think, to the guy who sells the tire? Oh, my God, look at this. And he shows me where it's really worn on the inside and not that much on the outside because things weren't aligned properly.
Yeah.
Yowza. We have a call on the line already. Here's Adam in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange and our Squeaky Wheel segment with Zach Edwards.
Hello, my name's Adam.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a 1989 Ford Festiva. It's carbureted with a mechanical fuel pump. And it suddenly died on me while driving down the road. All electrical components, everything seems to be working fine. I waited about 5 hours. It started up briefly for maybe 20 seconds, and then it died again, and it won't start.
All right, and it hasn't started since then?
It has not started since then.
Okay, so get some initial thoughts here from, and stay on the line here, and let's get Zach's take on this.
Yeah, so, okay. Hi, Adam.
Hey, Zach.
My first question, I guess, would be, you were driving on the highway, and it just kind of petered out.
I was driving on a side street, and it just suddenly and abruptly just quit running.
Okay. And then when you tried to restart it at that time, how did it crank over normally?
It would crank over. It would never start up, though, but it would keep cranking.
Okay. That's going to be a tough one over the phone, but you definitely would want to check and verify that you're getting fuel delivery. So you'd mentioned that you have a mechanical fuel pump. That's definitely one thing that I would suspect and would if I was looking at the car in the shop, I would want to run a test on the fuel pump. There's also, spark delivery that I would want to consider and maybe run a couple of tests. But it sounds like the fact that the car started, 5 hours later, just briefly, tells me that, there's something that's failed, but maybe not quite all the way yet. It's just clinging by a thread. But definitely a fuel pump would be something I would suspect, but would want to test.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling, Adam. Appreciate that. I hope that gives you a clue to head in the right direction. Which reminds me of a situation I had, and it was in wet conditions like we've had here lately. Years ago, different car that I no longer have. But I'd be driving, if I go across a really big puddle or something, all of a sudden all of the panel lights would light up. The car would keep running.
Mm-hmm.
But I no longer had low beam headlights. I only had high beams, stuff like that. It was just really strange electrical sorts of eccentricities. I mean, does water get up in there sometimes and mess with your electrical system?
It can, but of course cars are made to be able to withstand, you know, moisture in certain areas. Now, there are places where moisture is not supposed to be. What you're describing sounds like an alternator problem. Alternators can sometimes lose their ability to regulate, and then they overcharge. And when they overcharge, a lot of times lights come on that shouldn't be on. And one of those symptoms would be all the dash lights kind of faintly coming on, or sometimes brightly coming on. I mean, there's been times where we've had alternators in the shop, you know, be charging 20 volts when their normal voltage usually isn't above 14. So, you know, and alternators can catch fire when they really get going or bearings fail inside there. And so, yeah.
It's funny how we forget the fact that a lot of these things really work well most of the time. But when they don't, it can be upsetting.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we try and educate our customers at the shop, and 'cause they can be pretty down and out when they find out what it's going to cost to fix their car. And sometimes we'll hear some grumbling and moaning, and they tend to feel a lot better when we explain to them, you know, how much the car gives them and how reliable their car is, generally speaking. I mean, every day we get into this thing, we stick our key in, we crank it, it starts up, and we just take off and we go where we want to go multiple times a day, day after day, year after year. And cars really are amazing in terms of what they provide for us and what they allow us to do. And so when you consider all of that, and then you think about the maintenance needs and the costs, it makes it feel a little bit better when you really appreciate what the car does for us. So
Zach Edwards runs Ashland Automotive. He's our regular guest monthly on The Squeaky Wheel. So it's your chance to call in with some car care questions. 800-838-3760 by phone. Email jx@jeffnet.org. We have an anonymous from Medford email. Our 2010 Ford Expedition that we used to pull our 30-foot travel trailer has 90,000 miles on it. Right before this last snowstorm, it blew its transmission. We have been told that it costs around $3,500 to rebuild. Why did this happen at only 90,000 miles, and should we invest money to replace it? So there's the question about when you make the decision to cut and run from the old vehicle or stick with it.
That's a great question. There's a couple of different aspects to that question as well. So why did it fail? It probably failed because 90,000 miles is a lot of miles. But when you start pulling a big, heavy trailer on a transmission that has 90,000 miles on it, those two things combined can lead to a somewhat premature death. My advice to anybody who's buying a trailer and going to pull it with their existing vehicle, or vice versa, buying a vehicle to pull a trailer, would be to take it to their trusted shop and tell them, you know, I've got this plan. We're going to be pulling this 35-foot travel trailer with this car. What should I do to this car to make it, to prepare it for the excess load that it's going to be now dealing with? And so a secondary or auxiliary transmission oil cooler would be a really good idea, because when you're pulling a heavy load like that, the transmission and the engine take a, you know, they are just really loaded up. And so you have to put extra maintenance and extra take extra precautions for your powertrain components when you're going to be pulling any sort of weight on a regular basis. And so with this particular vehicle, you know, the 90,000 miles plus, that's a very large trailer, and I know the Expedition is a big vehicle and should be capable of that, but it's really dependent on also the maintenance history of the transmission leading up to that moment in time. Did they, you know, do regular oil changes in the transmission oil, which should be done about every 30,000 miles, and even more so if you're doing regular towing? And as far as the cost, $3,500, that sounds cheap to me. I would, when looking to invest that type of money in into an older vehicle, the consumer really wants to ask questions such as, you know, what's the warranty? And is the warranty local or is it nationwide? And how good is the company at honoring their warranty? Can I rely on the company to make good on their warranty, or are they going to hassle me when, if something comes up? These are the things that we've experienced where companies maybe offer a warranty, but then when it comes time to use it, they try and wiggle their way out of it. And so one brand that we use Jasper Engines and Transmissions, uh-huh. and they work really, really well and have a very long warranty, and it's nationwide. And so $3,500 or $5,500, either way, it's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And the consumer should be, you know, asking the right questions at their shop and making sure that they're going to get the most bang for their buck, because it is, you know, cars are worth investing in.
That that oil cooler you mentioned, if you're going to be towing something fairly heavy, the additional oil cooler for the transmission, mm-hmm. how much is that and how easy to install?
It's different on every vehicle, mm-hmm. But it's probably going to be less than $500 to install.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does really is allows a little bit larger capacity of transmission oil, but mainly it gives the transmission oil more surface area to dissipate heat. And so when you're towing, you're going to be increasing the temperature of the transmission oil. And so the conventional cooler might not have enough surface area to let that heat go.
All right. We're talking to Zach Edwards on The Squeaky Wheel, our monthly car care segment. He's from Ashland Automotive. You can join us at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to The Exchange.
Yeah, hi. Well, I have something that might be a puzzler for you.
All right.
I have a 2003 Volvo V40 wagon, and it has a persistent electrical problem where the cooling fan, if I just sit in the car, turn on the ignition, don't even start the car, starts the cooling fan running, and it will run for about 10 minutes. And this happens every single time I shut the car off. So I had to buy a quick charger so that I could keep going when I found myself out and about, and suddenly the car wouldn't start because didn't seem to be enough energy in the battery. And I've been taking the battery out every week or so and charging it up fully, and I just had the alternator checked and the battery checked, and they both check out fine, and yet this problem keeps happening, and even the Volvo dealership up in Medford couldn't solve it.
All right, let's see what Zach thinks about this.
Well, okay. Sandy, that's a great question, and I'm not going to lie, you're not the first Volvo owner to have this mysterious sort of electrical problem. We had a V40 in the shop that had the exact same problem, and it was a combination of two or three different issues. So one, there was a coolant temperature sensor that had failed. It was just out of calibration. But the other problem that we eventually discovered, and it was very, very difficult and a very arduous process for the customer and the shop, was we found a faulty, basically a faulty computer. I think it was either a cooling fan control module or it was that portion of the main powertrain control module. So the cooling fans, I believe, they're controlled by the solid state device. And there was a error in the calibration or in the algorithm for that fan control. And it required basically a replacement of the main computer, which controlled the fan. So I don't remember if it had its own module or if it was controlled by the main engine control module. Mm-hmm. But it was really difficult to diagnose. And, you know, it was one of those things. It ended up being quite costly for the consumer. Because, like I said, first there was the problem with the coolant temperature sensor that was slightly out of calibration. And anytime a shop is, you know, finds something out of calibration, you have to replace it. But you don't necessarily know if it's going to fix the problem. And so when you replace it and then the fan starts operating differently but still not correctly, it's always frustrating for, you know, the owner of the car, and equally as frustrating for the technician and the shop you know, communicating with the customer, because shops just want to fix cars. They want to make happy customers. They want to do good work for good people. And sometimes cars just are very, very difficult. So as a Volvo owner, I wish you luck. And, it's probably not your last electrical problem you'll have with the Volvo, unfortunately.
All right. Sorry about that, Sandy, but thanks for the call here on the squeaky wheel. We have another email from Ross in Talent, wants to know, what's the max safe speed while driving with chains on, especially open patches of road without ice?
That's a great question. I'm not even sure if I know that. The exact answer. It depends on the type of chain, I would think. You know, the cable chains, mm-hmm. I think you can go faster. And also it depends on how well you've installed the chains. You know, you want to have those things on there fastened on pretty well. If my best advice would be to get the chains on there, take a little test run, maybe go 100 feet down the road, and then jump back out in a safe spot, check the tension on those chains, and then I've seen people driving down the freeway with chains on maybe, 45 miles an hour.
Yeah, it seems like anything beyond that begins to get a little crazy. Check also on the box or whatever package the chains originally came in.
Absolutely.
Wanted to ask you before we go about road cinders, whether they get stuck in brake drums, things like that this time of year.
They do all the time, yep. And for people that get frustrated with that, I would just let them all know that's so much better than salt. You know, we can have salt on the roads, which they don't allow in Oregon, or they don't do in Oregon. So I'm always appreciative of the cinder, but they do get caught up in brakes, and they can make some gravelly grinding noises, and we've been dealing with that a
lot. Is it just
a
bad noise, or does it need to be attended to?
Sometimes they'll find their way back out like they find their way in, mm-hmm. and other times they do need to be, the brakes need to be taken apart and get that stuff out of there. But it doesn't usually cause any major damage.
Okay. Zach Edwards, The Squeaky Wheel, Ashland Automotive. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hey, thanks, Jeff.